This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. There are many people from all over the country who've never met you who think you might be guilty of murder. That is the reality Amanda Knox has been living in for almost a decade now. She became internationally known in 2007 after she was arrested for the murder of her British roommate in Perugia, Italy. Knox spent 4 years in prison before being acquitted. Now, she's back in the spotlight with the release of a new Netflix documentary about her case. So I asked Amanda Knox, what is it like to be constantly connected to this terrible experience?
When I enter into a room and I'm meeting people for the first time, it's like people are not meeting me for the first time. I go into a room and what I am facing is people's ideas about who I am. And they may be positive ideas, they may be negative ideas, they may be coming from a million different sources, and I don't know what they are. And I know that when I'm meeting new people, I tend to be up against that. And I have to just be aware that when I'm coming into a conversation, I tend not to be on an equal level with somebody. They have already an idea of who I am, and then I have to read that and understand that I'm presenting myself in relationship to what their already preconceived notion of me is. And that's just what it's like to be me.
Yeah. What is that like for you? What is it like to be you in that situation?
You know, a lot of exonerees have the same experience where it's this very bittersweet, it's this very, very bittersweet experience because I learned very quickly who are my people, and not in the sense of who believes me and who doesn't believe me, but actually who is it who is going to see me as a person, who's going to look past whatever notions are out there and try to engage with me as a person, because it's very easy, so easy to just like be sitting on what you already think about me. And when people open up to me and engage with me and start asking me questions that shows that they want to really get me and understand who I am, then I learn very quickly that those are my people and I hold on to those people.
I could really understand you never wanting to speak about that whole Italy episode again, and yet you've written a book, you've cooperated with these filmmakers, this new documentary, you're coming to talk to me about it. Why are you doing all of this?
When I first came home, I thought that I never wanted to deal with this ever again because it was this thing that was just thrown onto me that I had nothing to do with, that I was just being made the center of, but that I did not create. And I struggled for many years trying to reconcile my experience and my life and the way the world reacted to me and interacted with me with the fact that I'm just me. Like, I'm not this big thing that was put on me. I'm just me. And what I realized is that I was never going to feel better or feel like I had a grasp of my life and myself until I acknowledged what happened to me and until I recognized that I'm never going to be the kid who was just studying languages at the university again. I'm also the girl who was wrongly accused of murder. And when I recognize that, I suddenly feel like it's not just this thing that was put on me, but that I can feel empowered in relation to. Suddenly it's this thing that I can take ownership of myself, of my perspective, of my experience, and I can do what I will with that. I can go to poetry class and write poetry about it. I can interact with other exonerees for the first time and actually meet other people who get it and who don't have to ask the same kinds of questions, but who get to the heart of the matter much more quickly. So as soon as I accepted that I'm an exoneree and that I'm always going to be an exoneree and that the greatest good that I can do as an exoneree is give voice to that experience, that was when I felt like I had my life back again.
In Italy, you were convicted of murder. It was overturned. What do you have now as an exoneree? What do you take forward from that, from what's in your rearview mirror?
Wow, just a knowledge, like a very personal knowledge about how the criminal justice system can succeed and how it can fail, What are the types of things that actually happen in a police interrogation room? And what sort of knowledge and experience can be useful to other people? So not only just in relation to the criminal justice system, but also in relation to just living everyday life. It's hard, you know, it's hard to be objective about something terrible that happened to you, right? But what I do know from having gone through my experience is how easy it is to dehumanize other human beings because of some ideology or because of some fear or because of some agenda. And I never, ever want to do that to anyone. And because I know what it feels like. And I think that that kind of perspective would be really useful to many people when they think about engaging with people who disagree with them or, you know, with the political situation or just with like human beings across the world in general. We've all like misunderstood each other, and it takes being radically misunderstood to know how to try to open yourself to understanding other people.
What did you think of the documentary? Because you participated in it, but you didn't, I assume, decide how the filmmakers were going to come out. It's not like a proclamation of your innocence.
No. So, and that's, I think, what makes this documentary so interesting. My innocence was declared in court. That's not the question that's at hand right now. The question is at hand is, how did this happen? If there were stunning flaws in the investigation and there was never any traces that connected me to this crime, how could this go on for so long? How could this get to be so big? How can we still be disagreeing about what the evidence tells us definitively? And the answer to that is the way that we all engage with a story like mine, the story of someone who's wrongfully convicted. Because my case is exceptional in the way that it got tons of media coverage, but it's not exceptional in relation to what other exonerees went through. I mean, there was mistaken eyewitness identification. There was coerced false confession. There was shoddy forensic work. Like, these all happen all the time in cases that get swept under the rug.
Well, can we talk about, you mentioned coerced false confession. So you know something about this from both sides, because when you were being interrogated by the police, you falsely accused an innocent man, this Congolese man, your boss. What did that experience teach you?
Oh, gosh, that the kinds of interrogation techniques that we have available now can make anyone think and say anything. I was brought in the middle of the night, denied my rights, denied a lawyer, and told that I had amnesia from having witnessed the murder, and that if I didn't tell them, if I didn't remember what happened, I would lose my life. I would never see my family again. And that terrified me. They raised the stakes suddenly to, oh, you were someone who cared about Meredith and knew her and can help us with the investigation, to, you were involved, we know, and we know the truth, and you don't understand what's going on because you're traumatized, and we're going to tell you what's going on. You met this man because this is what your text message says. They're like, these kinds of techniques where they tire you, they make you weary, they confuse you, they feed you ideas and information, those are techniques that are legal and in use. And until we have the guts to say we need to examine what is going on in these interrogation rooms and not just let them sort of exist in this like weird space where no one gets to touch it except for the police, like, unless we do that, false confessions are going to continue to happen. They happen in over 25% of cases of wrongful conviction.
What role do you think race and nationality played in this? Because here, and it's clear in the documentary, these two men, the man who you falsely accused, Patrick Lumumba from Congo, Rudy Guede, also African, it seems like the those men were dismissed compared with how much attention was paid to you and Mr. Sollecito. And that's Italy, but how do you reflect on race and nationality and injustice here?
The numbers are staggering, and the numbers say more than anything that I could say. I mean, so if you take the fact that 13% of our population is Black, 63% of exonerees are Black. What that means is that the most vulnerable people to wrongful conviction are those of ethnic minorities, are those who are poor, are those who are overlooked by the system. The reality is that wrongful convictions are a terrible, like the price of a wrongful conviction is usually the life of a Black man who doesn't have the resources to defend himself.
We're talking with Amanda Knox and about the new documentary about her. And you made a remarkable statement in this documentary. You said, basically, either I'm a psychopath in sheep's clothing or I am you. What do you mean by that?
The prosecution presented me as a monster because that was convenient for their theory. They had to portray me as a monster because it didn't make sense for me to have done this. And the way that the media fed off that and then recycled that and then amplified it only made it so that there were two camps in my story where I was either a psychopathic monster or I was just a regular person. And when we want to believe that the justice system is on our side at all times, that an innocent person would never have to go through what I went through, that the safeguards of the system are enough to protect against what happened to me from happening, then the only other option is that I'm a monster. I'm not. I can't tell you what to believe. But what I do ask is that you recognize what it is you're saying you believe when you say that I'm guilty. And that it's coming from nowhere.
Finally, Amanda, what do you want from us, the people who live around you, who we weren't there? We may have no, honestly, Amanda, we've never met. I have no opinion about what happened.
Okay.
You know, but which has got to be, I don't know. Well, I don't know what it is. You live with that. But what do you want from us around you?
I would love for you to engage with me, kind of like all the people, like, you know, when, like I said before, how there are some people who dismiss me or who prejudge me and do so to other exonerees as well. What I would love and what I think is necessary for all of us to be better and to ensure that this stuff doesn't happen to anyone else is to really just engage with it and to discuss it and to be inspired by people who have survived it and to acknowledge that it's happening. I mean, one of the greatest healing devices that we can offer someone who went through a traumatic experience is to acknowledge that it happened.
So do you want a stranger to engage with you? I would imagine that you get way more engagement than you want. I mean, do you want people to come up and ask you about what did or didn't happen years ago in Italy, in Perugia?
I think that's oversimplifying the engagement. I would love to engage in discussion about the bigger picture and the way that we're all assuming things of each other or going out of our way to be patient with our judgment and examine things clearly with an open mind and not by dehumanizing someone, because it's very easy to come to a judgment when you've failed to recognize that the other person across from you is a human being. And that's a failure. I've had to acknowledge that this is a huge part of my life. And so, yeah, I'll go out of my way to come here in the morning and talk to you about what it means and why it matters to me, but also why it should matter to everyone, because they could potentially be me.
Seattle resident Amanda Knox. A new Netflix documentary about her case was just released on Friday. Today, Knox says she's applying to grad school and she's continuing her work as an activist for the wrongly convicted, especially today, October 4th. It is International Wrongful Conviction Day. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. When it comes to health care for transgender people, there is a void. Some doctors feel uncomfortable treating trans patients. Well, there's a new toolkit to help them and their patients. KUOW healthcare reporter Ruby DeLuna has that story.
For decades, Dakota Keough felt as though she was living a double life.
It started, you know, at that age where the boys and the girls go their separate ways, like 4 or 5, whatever that is. And I just felt like I'd gotten caught in the wrong tide. And I wanted to be over there.
Over there with the girls. But she felt like she didn't have any choice and kept those feelings to herself.
That was the early 60s, and I was in an Irish Catholic family with a former boxer for a dad. That just wasn't going to fly.
Over the years, she got married and started a family. Last year, at age 58, she came out as trans to her family and circle of friends. Earlier this year, she decided to start hormone therapy. At that time, she was seeing a couple of specialists for an unrelated health issue.
And at the point that the estrogen showed up on my medical record, they asked, "What's that about?" I'm like, "Well, you're a doctor. Do you really have to ask me?" And at that point, both of them got sort of very stiff, and their speaking became much more clipped and direct.
You picked up a different vibe.
Totally different vibe, yeah. A very uncomfortable vibe, and it's like, okay, whatever.
After the questions came up about the hormones, the specialists told Keough they didn't need to see her for a while. She doubted whether it was a coincidence. For many transgender patients like Keough, interactions like this have been all too common. A 2014 report by the National Transgender Discrimination Survey shows that negative experiences can have profound health impacts on trans patients. Many postpone seeking medical care because they fear discrimination.
When I speak to providers, they want to be able to provide good care. They just don't know how, and they don't necessarily always know where to look. And there is a reflex response of referring that patient to someone who specializes.
Claire Shirley is a nurse midwife. She wanted to do something to help trans healthcare. Her partner identifies as trans. She has seen and heard about the challenges in accessing care. As part of her doctoral project, Shirley created a toolkit so that providers don't have to send patients to a specialist. All they have to do is go online and get the information they need, including articles, resources, and even training modules.
We wanted to make it accessible to people who had never encountered a trans patient before. The doctor in rural Wyoming who has a patient walk into their office saying, "This is who I am. I need healthcare," and that doctor being able to say, "Oh, I need to learn about this so that I can provide the best health care," and there being a place for them to find that.
Take wellness exams. On the one hand, these office visits focus on the whole person, their medical history, their lifestyles, relationships. But there are things that are specific to trans patients, says Shirley, like gender dysphoria, feeling distress with the gender they're born with.
For a lot of the trans men that I know, whenever they have their monthly cycles, that can cause some gender dysphoria. When they have to go in for their pap smears, that can cause some gender dysphoria. So things that sort of remind a person that their body is not quite what they want it to be.
Shirley says that knowledge can help providers find ways to help the patient feel comfortable in their bodies. This summer, Cedar River Clinics launched the toolkit online and will keep it updated. Since coming out, Dakota Keough's experience in society has been uneven, but her family has been supportive in her transition.
Should we just go ahead and get started?
Keough sits still in the dining room at her ex-wife Sarah's house. Her daughter Adrian dabs on some foundation on her face and tries to blend it, but the sweat gets in the way.
I'm going to ask that you try not to sweat.
I will have an inner conversation with my pores.
Okay,
Dakota's other daughter, Amanda, looks on.
You didn't quite blend in on the temple there. Okay. See that? This is why I'm supervising.
Amanda and Adrian are helping Dakota get ready for a photo. It's a family effort.
So do you remember when Dakota asked you to do her makeup?
Yeah, it was like last week. I'm really happy to help and try to be supportive. So
Keough hopes the toolkit will help create a safe environment for trans patients to open up about their needs and provide the healthcare community knowledge.
Part of that, I put on the trans community, because there has been a prevailing attitude of accept me, respect me, and don't ask me questions. And that creates a bubble of ignorance. And when there's a bubble of ignorance, people tend to fill it in badly. So we need toolkits like this to try to undo that.
Keo says eventually folks will learn that we're just people. I'm Ruby DeLuna, KUOW News.
Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. At the store, you'll find cleaning products that advertise, "I kill bacteria." When you get sick, your doctor might prescribe you antibiotics. Well, B. Brett Finley says we're doing that wrong, especially when it comes to our kids. Finley's a microbiology professor at the University of British Columbia. In his new book, Let Them Eat Dirt, he says our cleanliness obsession threatens our children's health. And to understand how we got here, you need to go back about a century.
Because that's when they started to figure out that microbes that could cause disease, so infectious diseases. So these were called germs, and they realized if you brought in sewers and got rid of the rats and the mice, and you had clean food, clean water, you brought in antibiotics, and the infection rates plummeted. You know, 100 years ago, 30% of kids less than a year of one would die of an infection. Now it's 0.1%. So it worked. It worked really well, and we realized this. So I think what we experience now is really a hangover from that area that we realized we've got to keep things clean. So now, in the last 5 years, we suddenly realized that, well, when we swept out all these bad bugs, we get rid of all the bugs, period. And there's this been this massive cleansing of all microbes. And you think of how we grew up as a species, evolved as a species, we were basically exposed to all these microbes. And so now we realize these kids are not getting these microbes that are needed for them to develop early in life. And stunningly, we now realize these things are basically having a big effect on the Western diseases such as asthma, obesity, diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, brain issues. And these all have microbial links. And even 5 years ago, we had no idea. So the moral of the story is we cleaned up the world too much, and we got to rethink that because we got rid of the good with the bad, and this is having big consequences.
What good do microbes do?
Oh, they do many good things. They're absolutely critical for immune system to develop, for example. They're absolutely critical for the brain to develop. You can actually have animals that are basically sterile. We call them germ-free animals, and their brains don't develop normally. They're key for bone and muscle development. They're key for intestinal development. So they actually do have a role, and probably their biggest role is breaking down our food, because most of the food you eat, you don't break them down. Your microbes break it down, and then they feed you.
You've been studying the negative effects of bacteria for 30 years. How was it to begin to look at the positive side?
Yeah, we jokingly say diarrhea is my bread and butter because I work on microbes that cause diarrhea, E. coli and salmonella, and that's what I made my living at. And really, it all went back to a laboratory we had, and we were discussing, well, what about all those microbes in the gut? Could they possibly do anything? And because everyone knew they were there, but they didn't deal with them. But you realize if a diarrhea-causing bug comes in, it's got to compete with all these things. And so we then came back and started to look at that, and that got us in the door. And really, I think it's been a stunning, basically revolution of all of biology, how much these microbes are impacting so many different fields. And yeah, it's kind of weird studying the good bugs instead of, I used to think all microbes were enemies because that's what I worked on kind of thing. But now we realize all the good they have and how they influence us is really profound.
Then what is the right balance between protecting ourselves, our kids, and letting them get those healthy microbes?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's balance. So, I mean, you know, despite the title of the book, Let Them Eat Dirt, we're not suggesting shoveling dirt down a poor little infant in its mouth. I mean, there is a balance, but I think we have to rethink how we behave. So I think we have to allow our kids to have normal microbial exposures that we're depriving them of. For example, the simple act of getting a dog, that will decrease your asthma rates by 20% by just having a dog.
I don't want a dog, just to be clear.
Okay, well, don't get a cat because it doesn't have any effect. They live in a corner and they sort of give you the thumb.
So you should get rid of a cat.
I'm not going there. So anyway, yeah, then other things like, you know, how you're born, you know, cesarean section versus vaginal delivery, ironically, that has a 20% effect on your rate of getting asthma 5 years later, just by the microbes you encounter when you're actually born, because birth is a very messy business, but we actually need those microbes in the woman's vagina to actually start to break down the breast milk. And if you're born by C-section, the microbes are actually more like the mother's skin, and they don't have the capacity to break down breast milk. So biology set it up this way, and I think we're kind of blowing off biology in our, you know, our bubble wrapping these kids, and I think we're starting to see the consequences.
I think we know by now, don't use antibacterial soap, don't use hand sanitizer.
Right.
But when do we wash our hands?
Yeah, first of all, you're right. You use soap and water. You don't need antibacterial. Studies have shown they don't do any different, and you know, the FDA's recently got rid of one of those just because it didn't work. So soap and water, probably before meals, after going to the washroom, for example.
Why, number one or number two? Or both?
Whatever your preference. I mean, you know.
Well, I ask because I'm trying to recalibrate, and we shouldn't maybe wash our hands as much?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in a playground, you know, I was watching a mother watch her kid in the playground, and pretty much every time the kid, you know, got off a swing or went on to another thing, he ran back, got his hands sanitized, ran back again. No, don't do that. Maybe when the kid comes in for dinner after all that, you know, you wash the hands. And when I was growing up, you know, my brother and I had a competition of how big a ring around the bathtub of dirt we could actually make, and the bigger it was, the better the day it was, kind of thing. So I think, you know, you do have to use reason. You know, let them play in a sandbox unless there's cat feces in the sandbox, because cat feces can carry parasites, for example. You know, we jokingly say let them lick the floor in your own house, but probably not the subway, for example. You know, you sort of balance these things, and it is hard to do prescriptive things, but I think we just have to ease off a bit and realize that, you know, the chance of getting an infection these days are way, way less than 100 years ago. You know, it's a balance, and we got to figure out how to recalibrate that balance so these kids actually do get some microbes in their life.
You say you lick the floor in your own house, maybe jokingly, but I mean this because, for example, my wife wants our family to never share a fork or a cup.
Oh.
You know, don't bite your carrot and then dip it back in the hummus. We have
no double dipping.
no double dipping. That's her rule. So,
a lot of studies have shown that family lives together, shares their microbes. You know, you are going to be microbiologically more similar to your spouse than you will with your twin brother and sister on the other side of the world. We know we can actually tell looking at kids' feces whether they have a dog in the house and what kind of dog that is. So if you live in the same house, you share your microbes. And, you know, sharing fork or not, your microbes will be the same. So I wouldn't worry about that. I think you do need to think, you know, what is infectious? You know, if you have a very serious cold or something, no, don't share your fork. But under normal circumstances, you're not transmitting disease, share your microbes. It's a good time. Good family life, you know?
Did you hear that, honey? You listening? Well, let's talk about that then. You say, you know, well, of course, if you're around someone sick, a lot of parents are nodding, they're ready to believe what you've learned about microbes. Some parents, this is the way they do things, is the hand sanitizer, the antibacterial soap. How do you reach that person?
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, I certainly feel for these parents because they think they're doing their very best thing they can for this kid. And they've been taught that, you know, like you have to keep it clean and the kid will be better. And we all want to do the best for our children. But I think you have to steel up and think, okay, you know, maybe that's not actually the best thing for my kid. I mean, study after study is really showing that I'm just not smoking things. I mean, this really does have an effect. And if you truly care about your kid, I mean, you got to rethink this. And, you know, as much as it's going to feel a bit strange letting him, you know, lick that, you know, thing they picked off of the floor, it's actually, you just have to tell yourself it's in the best good for that kid to do that. And, you know, it's going to drive you crazy the first little bit, but then you realize they're fine, they don't get sick, you know, and you'll ease off a bit. And it'll actually make your life easier because you won't have to sterilize all your bottles and you'll actually get some sleep and you can chill out a bit and, you know, enjoy your kid more. So work at it. You know, make sure the vaccines are up to date in the child. That's really important for infections. And then go with the ride and let the kid be a kid.
Where should our listeners go for more information? Online is nice.
Yeah, but the problem online is unreviewed. At our book site, letthemeatdirt.com, we actually put a link to a really nice study that lists all the double-blind placebo clinical controlled trials of probiotics. So this is the one that will tell you which probiotics work for which disease, for example. So there's good there. We also tried to put a bunch of other information on, you know, healthy things you can do. And of course, the book, each chapter finishes up with a sort of a do's and don'ts based on the science. You know, some simple things that I learned, like if a kid spits their soother on the ground, you have a choice.
Soother meaning a pacifier?
One of the things you stick in the mouth. Sorry, maybe that's Canadian for pacifier. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, kid spits it on the floor. You've got two choices. You can actually stick it in your own mouth and back in the kid's mouth, or you can run to the bathroom and wash it off. And they actually did a study of a bunch of parents that did these alternate two different ways of doing it. And they found that if you stuck it in your own mouth, the kid actually had less rates of asthma and obesity than if you went and washed it off. So you're giving the kids more of your microbes, which presumably, you know, helps colonize these kids and decrease these diseases later. So there's a bunch of fairly simple things you can do. You know, antibiotics, obviously don't abuse them. Use them only if really needed. They just carpet bomb the microbiota. They kill good and bad equally, so only use them if they're needed, but if they're needed, definitely use them. Try and eat very diversified diets, and you know, I think the real thing is let kids be kids. I mean, a little kid in action, they are putting everything they possibly can in their mouth. If that was so bad, how come they're doing that? Wouldn't we evolve not to? So there's kind of this thought kicking around that, well, maybe they're sort of sampling their world. They know what world they're in, so they can get used to the microbes. So if they see them later in life, they won't react to them and cause, say, allergic diseases, for example. And it's just part of the natural. I mean, this is how we evolved as a species. You know, think how our ancestors were 1,000 years ago. I mean, kids were living very differently. Yes, they had infectious diseases, but they also had this microbial exposure. And kids these days don't get it.
B. Brett Finley is a microbiology professor at the University of British Columbia with the new book, Let Them Eat Dirt. And if you missed that part where he talked about a double-blind scientific study for which probiotic to use when, worry not, we are tweeting a link to that now at KUOW. You didn't think we were going to go the whole show not talking about the election, did you? Well, in Washington State, even in presidential election years, did you know only about 60% of the voting age population actually votes? That's not good enough, says Seattleite Eric Liu. He wants more of you to vote, whatever your politics are. Eric is the founder of Citizen University, which has launched a project called The Joy of Voting. He told KUOW's David Hyde that voter participation used to be higher.
Think about when women first got the vote about a century ago. Think about 60 years ago when the voting rights of African Americans were secured under law. These were moments where people were, and not just those affected, but people all around them recognize, wow, this is not something to be taken for granted. This is a privilege that many are denied or have been denied historically. And you have these beats in American history where people appreciate with a certain measure of spirit that this stuff matters, and they show up and they turn out.
And originally, voting was mostly for well-to-do white men. And as you mentioned, over time, that changes. And in those moments, more people get more excited about voting. But what was the culture of voting like in the 19th century?
Yeah, I mean, it was street theater and open-air debates. It was, you know, toasting, feasting, fasting. It was competing parades. It was a public culture that was raucous, creative, playful, imaginative, often artistic, theatrical, for sure, right? There was spectacle. Today, I mean, not just today, but for the last several decades, voting and our approach to politics has been very, number one, atomized, and number two, mediated. And that has everything to do with television and now, of course, the internet. We deal with politics through screens, and there's much less opportunity or obligation to do politics in person with each other.
So when did this change happen?
Well, I think the advent of television, you can track it pretty closely to that. Television became more of a force in American politics, certainly national politics, but even at the state and local level, everybody's incentives changed in the political system. Candidates and parties realized that, we need to put our energy, resources, and money behind this kind of mass communication and the effort to try to get people out at the precinct level in fun, festive ways was just not, quote, cost effective, right? And I think then from our side as citizens, we became spectators and politics became much less something about what we do in community together and much more about a TV show that we're watching. And, the candidacy of Donald Trump is sort of the, you know, what you get at the end of that process as viewers of a reality TV show.
So a lot of people won't remember when voting was this celebratory kind of festival, because that change starts to happen around, what, 1960 with Kennedy-Nixon?
Well, Kennedy-Nixon is that iconic moment. But look, you can be in your teens and 20s right now and think about other occasions where you do stuff face-to-face with lots of people, many of whom are strangers, who are from your community or city or neighborhood, and you do these things in public. It can be Pride Parade. It can be the marching band going to a Sounders game. It can be tailgating at a UW game. It can be all these things that people do collectively, ritually, creatively, and joyfully, right? It can be church. It can be, you know, whatever it is, that there are all these opportunities that people already have in their lives right now, where we express the spirit, but it's been drained out of politics. And our aim is to try to restore some of it to politics.
So what's the best example of something you're doing to try to turn this around?
Well, we've launched this project called The Joy of Voting, and we've done it in partnership with the Knight Foundation, which works in a bunch of cities around the United States where there either are or used to be Knight Ritter newspapers. We're focusing on four of those cities: Philadelphia, Miami, Akron, Ohio, and Wichita, Kansas. So a nice cross-section of regions, red, blue, you know, different kinds of places, larger, smaller. And each of these cities, we're organizing and inviting in artists, activists, designers, active citizens, neighbors, everyday folks to come together and generate ideas for small-scale, playful projects that revive the spirit of the joy of voting. And so in Philadelphia, it's this really fun voting-themed scavenger hunt through Colonial Old Town. In Miami, there's you know, all-night parties with really great DJs where the price of the ticket is literally you got to show that you're registered to vote.
Okay, but being a Seahawks fan or being fans of the same band is not the same kind of glue that used to hold voters together. It's not the sort of ethnicity or neighborhood or community that used to drive really big voter turnout in this country. So what do you hope to achieve from this kind of activity in 2016?
A couple, three examples just from the last few years of both local and national politics. Think about the Tea Party. Think about the $15 Now movement. Think about Shama Sawant's campaign for city council. In each of these, though, the issues and the people and the politics are all, you know, widely varying, each of these in different ways managed to activate this spirit of joyful, creative, collective, ritual, voice, imagery, theatricality, spectacle, right? It's true in all of these, whether it's candidate-based like Shama Sawant or ideologically based like the Tea Party activism or issue-based like $15 Now. In each of these cases, you had people, both activists, but again, citizens who got drawn in, who were drawn in part because there was this sense of this is not just some antiseptic political professional selling message at me, right? This is a chance for me to belong to something that speaks to my deeper sense of identity or aspiration or yearning or whatever it might be, and they tapped into that.
Talking with KUOW's David Hyde, that's Eric Liu, founder of Citizen University. They have launched the Joy of Voting Project. We will be talking more about the election this afternoon on KUOW when we ask, how did Donald Trump lose $916 million? Because of the economy? Because of his business decisions? That's coming up on KUOW's All Things Considered today. Here it is, early October, with a chance of rain all week long. Some people think this is book weather. Nancy Pearl tells KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman, no. Reading is not a seasonal activity.
For those of us who are avid readers, any time is reading weather.
Speaking of avid reader, what a great segue that is. You have brought in a book by that very title.
Yes, Avid Reader by Robert Gottlieb. And people who have read a lot about the publishing industry or The New Yorker will probably be familiar with the name Robert Gottlieb. And this is a memoir of a man who loves to read and has made his career centered around books and reading. He grew up in New York, son of a kind of typical Jewish family, middle class family in New York, went on to be an editor at Simon & Schuster, and then took over as the head of Knopf, and then was lured away because they were both Knopf at that time, Random House, which is the parent company, Random House, and The New Yorker were both owned by Cy Newhouse, who persuaded Robert Gottlieb to move to The New Yorker to be the person who would replace Mr. Sean, the soul of The New Yorker for many, many years. So Robert Gottlieb replaced Sean and Mr. Sean because he never wanted anybody to go by Bill. And then has continued. He's no longer doing that kind of work, but he's very active in the arts community in New York. What I loved about this book is that it's kind of a high-class gossip column. Let's not say high class, a literary gossip column, because he knew everyone and he worked with everyone. So he was the editor for example, Catch 22. And he tells the story, which some people will be familiar with, is that it was originally going to be called Catch 18. That was the title that they were going through the publishing process. And then there was an announcement in the trade papers that Leon Uris was publishing his new book, which was Myla 18. So they knew they had to change it, and they came up with 22. So he worked with best-selling writers. He is somebody who, he's in his mid-80s now, and this is not a book that settles scores at all. I mean, Robert Gottlieb, to me, reading this, came across as a thoroughly nice guy.
Since Robert Gottlieb started in the publishing industry, it has been transformed, I would imagine.
Yes.
And one of the things as you're speaking, Nancy, is that I started wondering was whether there are these kinds of jobs for avid readers anymore. Does that kind of pathway exist for somebody who loves the written word and wants to foster writers?
My experience, as limited as it has been with the publishing world, well, not so limited, it's been pretty yeah. extensive with the publishing world, is that yes, there is a place for that.
So you mentioned this was sort of literary gossip. Does Robert Gottlieb give any insight as to why he loves this kind of work so much?
I think that he is somebody who is full of enthusiasm, but it's an enthusiasm that goes outward in a way. I mean, his technique for editing is to have the perfect book. This is what he says, to have the kind of perfect book and not be concerned with how commercially successful it would be.
So you're telling me essentially this is a behind-the-scenes-ish memoir.
Totally. And it's so much fun.
The book is called Avid Reader, and if you are an avid reader, you'll probably love it. The author, Robert Gottlieb, Gottlieb. Nancy Pearl, that one sounds like a lot of fun for an October afternoon read.
Nancy was with KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman there, and you'll find all of Nancy's book picks at our website, kuow.org. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Have you noticed something fishy in your neighborhood lately called poke?
Poke is a Hawaiian dish, and it means to cut. So it's cubes of fresh fish, which is conveniently abundant in Hawaii.
Seattle-based food writer Angela Garbez, she knows poke.
Traditionally, it was made with native ingredients. There's a nut, kind of like a macadamia nut, and sea salt and seaweed. Now, what we think of as modern poke has some of the Asian influence, because Hawaii is made up of Hawaiian cuisine is influenced by a lot of Asian cultures, Japanese, Korean, Filipino, Chinese.
So you get the sesame oil.
Yeah, sesame oil, soy, maybe some chilies, some citrus. So it's a really fresh, bright, clean dish.
Now, before I asked Angela why so many poke places are opening now in Seattle, I asked her whether she likes it.
Oh, I love it.
All right.
It's delicious.
And this is a happy topic because
yes.
It's big in Seattle lately.
Oh, it's a thing. It's happening.
Why is that a thing?
Well, you know, I mean, I think people like to think of it, you know, we think of trends as things that, oh my gosh, where did it come from?
Uh-huh.
Suddenly poke is everywhere, right? But I mean, if you think about it in terms of like the way we talk about like Trump's candidacy, like how did this happen? If we look back, this has been happening for a while, right? And there are things that you can trace.
So poke is like Trump's candidacy.
Well, I just wanted to point out that it's the things that we think come out of nowhere often have been brewing. And I think that Seattle it's certainly something that's happening across the country, but I think we're uniquely poised to sort of ride the moment of popularity that it's having, partly because It's important to remember that there's been a long-standing Hawaiian cuisine and culture here in Seattle. You know, there are restaurants like Kauai Family Kitchen in Georgetown or Kona Kitchen up in Northgate that have been making Hawaiian food for a long time because we're a Pacific Rim city, so there's been a lot of immigration and from Hawaii here. So that's sort of been burbling around for a while, but we think of Hawaiian food as being heavier. We think of things like spam musubis. We think of kalua pork. Mm-hmm. We think of mac salad and white rice and huli huli chicken, things like that. And so that's always been here. So I think there's a familiarity, right? We've had more recently restaurants like the Marination restaurants and Ma'onu in West Seattle that have sort of brought it into even more popular consciousness. So that's been happening. And then I think we've had this, well, we have a proximity and access to really good fresh seafood. And we love seafood here in Seattle. So there's that. That's been happening for a long time. And, you know, we love sushi here and Japanese culture has been a big part of it. But I think there's also this moment that we're having where people are really into eating healthfully here in Seattle now. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean I'm just having a salad. You know, it means that we have these beautiful things like grain bowls. You know, there's cafes on Capitol Hill and Queen Anne and Fremont that do these wonderful grains with vegetables and proteins. And what we're seeing now is a lot of poke bowls. And I think it fits right in to how Seattle likes to eat at the moment.
It's light, it's quick, delicious. Where do you get poke in Seattle?
Where do you live? Because you can probably get it close by. I live on Beacon Hill, and I can go to Sam Choi's Poke to the Max in Hillman City or Super 6 in Columbia City. If you want to get out of the office and you have a few extra minutes, you can go to Wallingford to the 45th Stop and Shop, which is a mini market where the Erotic Bakery used to be.
Uh-huh.
And in the back, they have a poke stand that apparently is very popular, and there's a line. There's a new place that just opened in the Central District called Seattle Fish Guys. If you want to get it in the market setting, you can get it at Mutual Fish on Rainier, which has been selling poke for a while. And also metropolitan markets all across the city have it. And apparently there's a poke store coming to the ID at the end of the month and another one on Capitol Hill, I hear.
Will poke be a permanent fixture? I mean, as you said, it's always been around, but do you think it's going to be at this level for a good long time in Seattle?
I don't see any reason why not. We have access to this beautiful seafood, and I think it'd be great if it stuck around. It gives us another chance to learn more about Hawaiian cuisine and culture, which, you know, we think of Hawaii as, it's a state, you know, here in the United States, but it's actually its own country, and there's a lot to discover about its cuisine and culture through poke.
Tuna, I've had much tuna poke. Don't know if I've had salmon poke, but it's
okay,
a thing.
Maybe this is a slightly controversial position.
Oh?
I think I prefer salmon poke.
Is that controversial? Why would that be
controversial? Well, I don't know. I mean, I think of tuna as being the more traditional preparation, yeah. And then I think of salmon as being our Northwest twist.
Uh-huh.
But I love it because salmon has such natural fattiness and oiliness, and it has there's just a texture. There's something that happens on the tongue that I really enjoy the salmon version.
I'm enjoying how much you're enjoying it right now. Do you want to eat poke more when it's summertime or now that it's getting dark and so stormy and wet?
Well, me, I'd eat it whenever.
Yeah.
I mean, in the way that it can be transportive. So if it's, certainly I think it was probably, these poke places might be a little bit busier in the summertime, but in the wintertime, I'm trying to eat things that remind me of being perhaps in a tropical location, so it's a year-round thing.
Is Seattle known, or will it we be known for poke nationwide?
Well, I think that we're a little bit ahead. There's a trend, definitely, of poke places opening up. I read something on the website Eater. I want to say that it was Google searches for poke bowl are up 355% like in the last year. Something crazy like that. But as I said, we have this tradition, and we're closer to Hawaii than a lot of the country. So, and we have here one of the owners of a restaurant who had a few food trucks for the last couple of years, Sam Choi, is known, his nickname is the godfather of poke. He's a very well-known Hawaiian chef. So, yes, I think we're in a position to be a leader in the poke movement, whatever that means.
Right. The Seattle twist on poke is salmon. Is that about it? Is there otherwise any difference?
I mean, I think of that as a Seattle twist, but maybe it might be something that they do in other places. But, you know, of course, we're accommodating of lots of different kinds of people and their dietary restrictions and preferences, so you can find tofu poke around town as well. I've also seen octopus, which is called taco, so there's taco poke and snapper poke as well. But I think maybe tofu might be another regional strong.
That might be a Seattle thing.
Yes.
Angela Garbez is a food writer for The Stranger. If you found good poke in Seattle, tell us where. Write to us at record@kuow.org. Thank you for tuning in today to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Quote, the black community has been through a lot lately. So says the Association of Black Psychologists. The group calls the killings of black men by police, quote, just the most recent events in an ongoing assault on our humanity. And local therapists say they are seeing more people of color turn to therapy for help with what they call racial stress and trauma. Three Seattle therapists told KUOW about this, how racial stress has a ripple effect that can touch future generations. They shared suggestions for coping with the stress, like periodically turn off the news and tune in to self-care. Another is find communities where you can talk. You'll find that story on the homepage at kuow.org. What about you? What does racial stress feel like to you? How do you cope with it? Who do you talk to? Let us know. You can comment on KUOW's Facebook page or write to record@kuow.org. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today.